Welcome to Series 2 of the Social Care Podcast, Sharing Stories, with me, Audrey Moore, and David Bagnall, a.k.a. Baggy.
This podcast is for the benefit of anyone working in or studying social care. We like to chat with interesting people in the social care world and hear their stories.
Anyone who knows us will know that Baggy and I are very different in many ways. However, we share a number of common values, including respect and compassion for all, a love of working in social care, and a strong desire to elevate the profile of social care work, to have it recognised as the profession that it is. And we hope that this comes through in this series.
Welcome to the latest episode of the Social Care Podcast, Sharing Stories. Today, I'm delighted to welcome, along with Audrey, Martin McGinn, who is a company director of the National Institute of Intellectual Disabilities and Studies. And she's a training consultant. And I happened to sit down with her a couple of weeks ago and have a nice cup of tea and a chat. And she has some very interesting stories about her, herself and her business, and how she came to be doing what she was doing. So, Marta, you're very welcome to the podcast.
You're very welcome.
Thanks very much, David and Audrey. Yeah, I have to say it's a real pleasure to be here. I was delighted to be asked. So I know one of the things we talked about, David, was, I suppose, my story. How did I actually get into working with people with disability? And I suppose I have a fairly strange story there. But yeah, I grew up in a big household, a big family. Father died very young. So mother went out to work to kind of support us. So as the oldest girl, I took on the family role of taking care of everyone and cooking dinners for eight people at the age of 10, etc. I was groomed, if you like, into the caring world. I suppose the role I took on my family did take a toll on my studies. And consequently, when I left school, I had failed at leaving. So I thought it was a good idea to go back and do it again. But sadly, I failed it a second time. So I was really left quite adrift after school. And I ended up in various different jobs. And I ended up working for actually the Kildare County Council, what was supposed to be the Parks Division. But it turned out I was actually out on the roads back on the early 80s. One of the first females ever to work on the roads, filling potholes, painting seats, painting down white lines down the middle of the road, etc., etc.
That's amazing. And do you know the CEO of Kildare County Council is a woman right now?
Oh, yeah, rock.
Yeah, that's amazing. Sorry, go ahead.
But we were after going through a really, really bad winter. I mean, it snowed, it was freezing out there, and it was getting tougher and tougher. And early 84, we got a call to say that the canal in Kilcock, there was a voluntary group clearing it out. So we were asked to go over and support them. So we went over anyway, and I was on road duty. So I found myself on a bridge in Kilcock with an illuminous orange jacket and a go and a stop sign. And I stood there, and I'd say every second car that went by, they knew me. And anything like the slagging I got, everywhere I went, everyone is singing, "Oh, don't forget your shovel if you want to go to work." So I knew that day I had to do something different. I had no idea what it was going to be, but I knew I was going to have to find a way to do something. So I struggled for a few more years, and eventually, through a lot of different hoops, I worked in America, different things back here. But I eventually actually did an interview in Dublin, and I was actually working with the St. John of God's as I was coming and going to America, trying to figure out what I was going to do. And then a couple of English nursing companies came to Ireland, and they did what was called the DC-10 tests. This was like an IQ test. And when I went for it, I went down to Cork, and it turned out I got the highest in the class with 300 people doing it.
Wow, I haven't heard
and
of that.
That was, yeah, yeah, it was in, no, this was back in 87, probably 88. So I got loads of offers of nursing at the time, but the one I wanted was intellectual disability. And the only thing that was available actually was a what was called a dual course. So I trained as a nurse and a social worker together, which I tell you was very tough, because I'd gone from, remember, failing the leaving. So I had no discipline around doing exams or anything like that, to doing two distinctly different courses at the time. So that was a real challenge, but I got a lot of help, I have to say, And emerged out of that with a dual qualification in social work and nursing for people with intellectual disability. And I was thinking at the time that maybe that would become like a third profession. That didn't really emerge. I think it took too much, I think, out of the participants. You know, very few people actually qualified at the end. Anyway, from there, I went on and I worked, and I always worked with people with complex needs. Even actually when I was working in St. Rayfields at 19, I was in a secure setting. Very often you'd be on your own with five or six men with very, very complex behaviour. But I knew how to deal with that because I'd grown up with a house full of brothers and knew how to keep them all in order and whatnot. And I wasn't intimidated by aggression, I suppose. So I was able to develop quite a rapport with the men there as well. And that was something I guess I brought into the work, was that I wasn't intimidated by aggression. I was always able to see it as kind of a secondary feeling, if you like, and that there was always something underneath it. And if you could get to what was underneath it, you could really develop a good rapport in that.
Finding the function of the behaviour.
Oh, absolutely. It's all about that. Yeah, it's all about that. And to know that people are always trying to tell us something, you know, always. Yeah. So it's, you know, it's us. We're the ones that don't have the intellectual disability. So we need to use it like a set of clues and keep working them out to try and figure out what are they trying to communicate.
So all the years that you've been doing this kind of work then brought you up to setting up your own business. And like from the conversation we had, and from what I know of you, it's a passion of yours to push on with training in specifically the disability service. You want to tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, about 2007, I started working on my own and I just found I was a bit like a leaf in the wind. I was becoming whatever people needed. You know, people would ring me up and say, oh, can you do this? And we develop a course for that. Could you do the other? We develop a course for that. And that was great. Don't get me wrong. I really enjoyed it. But it did feel like that it had evolved rather than there was any strategic plan around it. So my niece, who's a psychologist, and she was doing her doctorate and she was looking for an interest to study her doctorate. So we got talking and I was sort of saying, look, I'm very conscious. The disability sector is becoming a new emerging world. There's a lot of new legislation, a lot of policy initiatives. You know, I'd love to be able to provide something that would really enhance the future development of services and specifically enhance the lives of the people who use the services. So we kept talking and she started to put some thoughts together and talking to the college that she was doing the doctorate with. And eventually she did a survey and the survey had two components. One was to talk to service providers and the other was to talk to frontline staff. And the questions really focused on with this new expectations with HICWA around, with new directions, congregated second report, assisted decision making bill on the horizon, etc. You know, what is the futuristic development needs of both the services and the individual staff? So what came out of that was the thinking that what they really needed was kind of a competency framework to fully understand what the role, the new role really entailed. And for organisations to have a clear vision on how to develop their staff going forward so that they could provide services that are more fitting to people today and that really match the expectations of people in disability services today. A lot of people, they want jobs. They want to be supported in very specific ways. They want to live their lives without restriction, without restraint. They want relationships. They want to maybe be able to live without the influence of parents or staff. Indeed, you know, I suppose they're looking to, and I love this new word that I've learned recently, individuation. They want to grow separate from services, separate from their parents and families, and really become the best version of themselves that they can be.
Sorry, I have a question.
Yeah. Great.
Well, I worked in St. Rayfields for 15 years as well, believe it or
and
not.
You never said hello.
So I think there might have been some overlap between when I started and you left, because I started in 2004. But I was working at the community houses with people with intellectual disabilities. One of the big distinctions that I would have noticed when I worked there was the distinction between those people who were living on campus, which is, I'm assuming, where you were working, and those people who were living in the community, and the models of care that were used in the different settings. So it was very much a social care model used in the community and a medical model, or at least that's what I perceived it as, on campus. And how do you think that your framework, your competency framework, would kind of work in both or either or those settings? Like, is it developed in particular for the medical model side of things or the social model, or is it meant to be kind of superseding all of that?
Yeah, absolutely. It would supersede all of that, definitely. So we would have looked at, I suppose, the needs of people rather than the roles of the people who provide it. So we would have taken it from a person-centered perspective. And no matter where somebody is living, you know, like nobody needs a medical model or nobody needs a social model. What they need is for people to understand their needs and to have a model that suits those needs. And thank you for bringing that up, because that's actually the first thing we did when we, so before we start trying to sell anything, what we thought was a really useful tool was to develop a competency framework. And the competency framework is developed around six core principles of support. So, for example, person-centeredness, respect and dignity, safety, professionalism, leadership and supervision, etc. And then they're broken down into practice areas. And then what we've looked at is what is the role of maybe a frontline worker supporting people through that maze of competencies? What is a supervisor's role? And then what would be maybe the likes of a person in charge or a registered provider role? Because all three of them have a role in person-centeredness, in person-centered planning. But while people may have some health needs, and maybe it is best that they're served by somebody who has a background in health, everybody has health needs and everybody has social needs. Like, everybody has the right to be included in the community. Everybody has a right to work, etc. So really, the skill set needs to go beyond the parameters of a role. Like, the service user's needs are not defined by somebody's role. The service user's needs are defined by their own needs. And I guess no matter who's providing that support to them, they need to be able to adapt to the needs of the person. And that's really what the competency framework was developed for. Now, how we were hoping it would be used, I suppose, is the next thing to move on to. So we said there were six core areas. So there's professionalism, safety, person-centered planning, dignity and quality services, and community and culture. So they're the six kind of main principles. And then each one of them are broken down into specific practice areas. So our plan was that we would have one set of competencies for a frontline worker, a second set then for kind of a supervisor, and a third then for like a registered provider role. So we envisaged that the way they could be used would be those multiple ways. So first of all, an individual social care worker, for example, working towards CURU might not know where to start with that journey. So one way would be that they would get one of the competency frameworks set out for the role that's pertinent to them at this stage. And then they could either go through it on their own or with a supervisor or with a colleague. And they could identify areas that they feel they're not as competent in. And then they might match that against the people they're supporting and say, you know, I'm working with somebody, let's say, for example, who's nonverbal, and I've never actually done any training in how to engage with somebody who's nonverbal. Or I'm working with somebody who is very lonely and they want to make friends with other people and they don't know how to do that. And I actually don't know how to help them with that. So that might be a good starting point. And then from that, then they would identify their own training needs. And then, of course, we have our e-learning campus. And our e-learning campus is a campus with a lot of different online self-paced training programs. Now, there's kind of two different types. One type that we have are really, I suppose, they're generic skills that are needed for every workplace. So they're supervision skills, their train-to-trainer skills, their how-to-write-report skills, their career development skills, their how to be part of a team, how to manage conflict and how to negotiate, and all those skill sets that are really relevant to the cohesive running of any team. Now, we purchase those, and then the other set we've developed, and they are very much about trying to develop intellectual disability specific or disability specific skills. So we're developing these all the time, and we have quite a range of them. Like, we've one set which is all about understanding and responding to the needs of maybe somebody with autism, somebody with a moderate intellectual disability, somebody with a severe intellectual disability, somebody with cerebral palsy, etc. Then we have another whole set on supporting people to develop relationships and sexuality. And we have another lot then on, let's say, what is restriction, what is restraint, the law, consent. So we're developing these, and we're going to keep on developing them. They can be used then as part of an organisational toolkit, and the organisation could use them maybe, first of all, to identify the job description for a particular area of practice based on the individual's needs that they'll be supporting. They can use that then to recruit for recruitment purposes. They can use it then for induction training. They can use it to monitor the performance of staff in the early stages of their work. They can use it for supervision. They can use it for developing people and molding them into roles as well. They can use it to prepare people to take on more advanced activities or prepare for promotion. And that's how an individual staff could use it as well. They could use it actually to prepare to take on more challenging tasks. They could use it, you know, if they're career minded, if they're career focused, if they're wanting to maybe move up through the ranks, etc. They could use the platform as well to develop their expertise in different areas. So that's kind of how we would envisage the competency framework and the eHub being made available to people. Either an organization would purchase it and they would make it freely available to the staff within it, and they would use it as a performance enhancement tool for the entire organization. Or individual staff would purchase, first of all, the competency framework and then select different e-learning programs that they would like to engage in then going forward. And they would pay for them as they go. Or we have had some thoughts. Somebody asked us about maybe developing a membership. So people would have an annual membership and then they would have unlimited access to all of the modules at any time, day or night, 24/7, etc. So within each of the modules, it's not just content. I mean, we've tried to be very careful to keep them very engaging. But what we've also done is we have set up at the end of every lesson discussion points. And our suggestion is that these are either discussion points you would have with your supervisor, so that you can really consider how you can bring that knowledge into your practice, or you do that on your own or with a peer. And you can also use it then to develop your portfolio for Kuru, because that's what Kuru would be looking for. They're not just interested that people did a particular training for an hour. What they're more interested in is whether or not there was any relevance of that training to the people they're supporting, how they've brought that knowledge into their work with individuals, how it's influenced or changed practices, and what the outcome of those practices were as well. So we've kind of asked in every lesson, we're asking questions to get people to think like that. So therefore, let's say they've only done an hour training, but they could end up actually getting an enhanced amount of points awarded for that course because of how they've integrated that knowledge.
Yeah, a lot of new learning. This podcast is sponsored by Trust Social Care Consultancy. If you want to get in touch with Audrey, please go to www.trustconsultancy.ie. Now back to the podcast. So I have a couple of questions, Martha.
Great.
Like, how many organisations have adopted this competency framework to date?
Yeah, so we've had, I suppose it's only really just available now, and we're having discussions with a couple of different organisations, but we recognise that we're not really marketeers. So we're going to organisations and maybe they ask us questions and we have to come back then and maybe think about answers to it and things like that. So we have engaged somebody now to work alongside of us who is a marketeer. And he is doing a lot of work at the moment. He's going to take on really, I suppose, approaching customers now to try and get them to adopt this way of working. Okay.
So sales and marketing and stuff like that. And my next question was, how does this fit with what they're teaching in social care courses or ID nursing courses? Because there's a lot of what you're saying already in those courses.
Yes, I think it is. But maybe the flavour I get is from services that find maybe they're out of their depth with that. So that's usually where my experience comes in. When I'm kind of reviewing how come the staff maybe are finding that they're the person may be engaging in behaviour of concern, I suppose the more complex the behaviour is, the more likely it is that the knowledge they have doesn't extend far enough to help them to influence the way they're providing the support. So, for example, they may have done a lot of work around how to support somebody who's nonverbal. But when the person gets distressed, then despite the fact that they don't understand language, they start talking to them. And that then overwhelms the person and can very often lead then to the person getting even more distressed. And that's a common thing. Or they overestimate how much they understand. So it's not uncommon for staff to think that somebody is really very intelligent and knows exactly what they're doing. Now, if they think like that, then the likelihood is they're going to miss the messages that the person is actually trying to send them.
From experience I've had is that sometimes when your client group is changing, you know, like say your core client would have had a specific disability, and then it may be a second or a third in the list of severity. You're getting new clients in with different behavior, different physical issues. And then the staff team need to train up because they haven't dealt with this before. So that would be a deficiency. But I've also found as well that it's something that I've gone back to over the years is that the experience of people from second or third careers coming into social care with the life experience of just dealing with what life throws at you is something that's missing in some cases with young students coming out who haven't had the time. I don't stress that's not their fault, but they haven't had the time to cope with difficult situations and to learn on their feet where they need somebody to come along and say, like what you do. And Audrey does it as well. I have great admiration for people trying to say, don't work this way anymore. Try this way and maybe integrate the two of them. You know, that one isn't right and one isn't wrong, but there's a middle space. But I think that, sometimes it's experience, but also I think a big thing is the changing client group that we're not used to dealing with.
Yeah, I think like service users are, particularly I suppose, where they have complex behaviours, generally speaking, they have multiple diagnoses. And that is very hard. It's very challenging for somebody maybe who has bits and pieces of lots and lots of information, but hasn't had the opportunity to really ground it into what does that mean in reality for this person? Like they're supporting somebody maybe with ADHD and do they fully understand that as a condition? And that's where we see as well, like maybe a lot of restriction is used in those cases as well, because they've learned a bit about it. They haven't learned enough about it, about how to maybe consider much more dynamic and flexible ways of engaging with them or supporting them as well. And then I suppose there is like, there's a lot of things maybe that they don't learn as well in those courses, like person-centered planning, for example. And that's another program that I do a lot. And usually I start the training off by asking, like, what have you done up to now? Because it's 2023. We've been talking about person-centered planning for years. So what have you done and what impact has it made on the people you're supporting? And I guess the feedback I'm getting is that it has a limited impact, that it's more like a wish, kind of a three wishes. You know, it's a lot of time spent on trying to put goals together that are not really going to have a huge enhancement of the person's life. Yeah, it might be a nice day out or it might be nice to do that, but that's not really what person-centered planning is about. It's about lifestyle planning.
Well, where you have had people working with specifically person-centered planning and they have that down pat and perfectly, that in previous times would have been influenced by their next of kin, which is not there now, and their contact person doesn't have the influence on their lifestyle changes and decisions, whereas that has to be taken into account now, and consent. So even if you just take the three of those together, there could be a lot of conflicts in that between the client, the family members, the staff, and it's a tough thing to figure out.
It is, and it's tough to navigate it, but these are the real issues that are facing people in their lives today with disabilities, and we're not going to serve them very well unless we can take those thorny issues and help move people's lives on. And the idea that, you know, services and staff within them, without maybe being supported, have ended up going along with a parental choice. Like, we really can't do that anymore. But it's the how do you do that? It's the know-how of how you go about that without causing conflict as well, because the person still needs that familial support. So you don't want to isolate them either. So
yeah,
so it opens up a need for a whole range of ways of thinking and practicing as well.
I know. And anyone who works with people with disabilities know that that's, you know, a very difficult line to tread, keeping the wishes of the parents in mind while you're helping the person to live their preferred life. So I suppose parents can go on and do these courses as well, though, can't they?
Anyone can, yeah. Like
at this moment in time, where would people go to find out more information, and what exact courses are there available for people to do right now?
Yeah, there's a lot on the platform. So yeah, they would go to www.niids, and then if they go to the top right hand corner, there's the eHub, and if they click that, then they will get into our online training suite, is our eHub, and then they can play around that. We're working on the background, so every time they go on, they might see something a little bit different. We're trying to line up the modules with the competency framework, which is a lot of work, and we're going to keep persevering with that in the background. But yeah, so like I said, there's a variety of different suites, and that's kind of what we call them. We're trying to develop them as part of a particular theme. So we have the competency frameworks, and they're done, there's three of them. Then we have the suite of understanding different sort of syndromes, etc. We have some stuff on mental health, the impact of disability on the family, diabetes and people with intellectual disability, cerebral palsy, ADHD, the role of professionals. We have different bundles then, like the relationships and sexuality program as well.
That would be a big one for you to be working on, I'd say.
Yeah, that was very, very challenging. And we did some webinars on them over the last 2 weeks, and we had over 600 people sign up for those webinars.
Wow, that's brilliant.
Yeah, yeah. No, obviously they didn't all come, but it just shows you the interest is there. And I think people are recognizing loneliness as a serious issue facing people with disabilities today.
Yeah, those taboo things, isn't it, for getting over the fear of what your child, young person will have in the future. You don't want them to be alone, but then it's also the thing of where do you cross over from friendship to sexuality is always a difficult question to broach.
And I think the message we were really trying to promote is, like, everybody needs connection, everybody needs friendship, everyone needs warmth. So actually starting out with that and helping people to make those connections and not jumping straight away to the fact that they're going to have sex. It's like, whoa, slow down. You know, will you bring it back to where the person is at?
I know people get very scared, don't
they? Oh, they do. Yeah. It's like,
it's difficult as well if it's a religious organization that's actually providing the support, because there's a conflict. While it shouldn't have an impact, it does.
Yeah. Well, I guess I get these very strange phone calls sometimes. Now, I do think maybe once or twice some of my colleagues were getting people to wind me up, to be honest with you, because I remember getting this call from a service, and it was really complex what this guy was doing, you know. And anyway, after I kind of got over the who the hell got you to ring me about this, I then sort of said, oh my God, you know, people seem to only think about it when something really bizarre is happening. And they're, you know, they're at this, we need an expert to come in and talk about it. Well, I'm thinking maybe with that you do. But actually, relationship development is something most of us engage in every single day of our lives. And yet we can't seem to simplify it enough to start helping people with intellectual disabilities make the connections, you know. So this is why we've developed these six modules. The first one is really to look at our own attitudes, to look at our organization's attitudes and values, to look at family, to look at all those barriers, but in particular to examine yourself as well. Then the second module looks at sexual development, right through from childhood through to adolescent, through to adulthood as well. And it also looks at typical development and concerning development so that people can be more mindful of what do we need to be concerned about. Module 3 takes a human rights perspective of relationships and sexuality, and it looks at the law and consent and all the assisted decision making, etc. Module 4 then looks at relationship development, and it looks at loneliness and how to develop friendships, etc. And then looks at how to ask someone out on a date, how to prepare for a date, where to go for a date, what to talk about when you're on a date, you know, just really practical stuff like that. And then it also looks at people maybe who do want to have something more intimate as well, and gives a lot of very good practical advice on that. And module 5 then is strategies for all staff. And it's really how to work those questions that service users might have, you know, when they're watching Coronation Street. I'd like to have a girlfriend, or I'd like to have a boyfriend, or whatever. And for frontline staff to feel comfortable and confident to be able to grow those conversations, to work towards the person meeting their relationship goals, etc. And then module 6, really for the registered providers and people participating in it, to look at whether or not their organisations support the development of relationships, or in what way does it hinder them, and to help them overcome some of those difficulties as well. So that's a kind of a style of how we've developed that particular group of modules. If it's successful, it might be how we'll do other things going forward.
So anyone can go in here, sign up for a course.
Yeah.
And the course is kind of person-led, they do it themselves on the e-hub. It's not like a teacher in the classroom.
No. Okay. But there's quizzes, there's case scenarios, there's discussions, discussion kind of suggestions to have with your supervisor, or to just reflect on and think about. So there's definitely an awful lot of interactive stuff going on within the modules.
Most people will want to know this. Is there an exam or an assessment for these modules?
So, the quizzes, I suppose. There's quizzes, yeah. And then the discussion things are really about enhancing your knowledge and considering how you bring it back into practice. But no, there's no kind of, there's no way you'll do them and then fail. There is not a failure factor.
I suppose, and if you're paying to go in, you could probably go in as many times as you want.
They stay available for a good 3 months once you go in.
Right. So you have 3 months to do it at your own pace. Whatever course. Can you give listeners an idea of the cost of these modules or these courses of the competency framework?
So we've them categorized as A, B, C, D, and E. So A is $19.99, B is $29.99, C is $39.99, and I think the dearest one is $79.99. But then you could get a suite together, and that brings down the cost then as
well. So you could group them together.
Yeah. Now, not everything is groupable, because that's actually quite a lot of work from our point of view, but we've started to put what we're calling bundles together now. So let's say if you're preparing to become the role of a PIC, there's a bundle with supervisor, you know, for a supervisor, how to supervise staff, and a variety of different skill sets within that. Or it could be on developing team meetings, or so those bundles then, you know, you could pay €130 and you could have 6 modules in it. Okay.
So it's a great resource for anyone working in disability services, or anybody who wants to get involved in working with disability services. Maybe they have their degree, but maybe they've been working in a mainstream residential or a homeless service or something for a long time, and they want to dip their toe into disability services. They can go in here, have a look, do a few modules, and then have something to put on their CV in terms of that. Yeah. But also I'm thinking, like, we know that Karoo registration is opening on the 30th of November this year. And after the grandparenting period, people will be starting to do their CPD portfolios.
Yes.
And there's going to be plenty of resources there that people could use if they want to.
And that's really what we were aiming for as well. And I know you know Charlotte, of course, and I would have talked to Charlotte extensively before we put the discussion questions together.
Very good.
Because what we were trying to do is line them up with what Curra would be expecting in terms of portfolio development.
Yeah.
So that's the style of the questioning. It's really to support that development. Yeah.
Brilliant that those links are there. And so that everything is kind of tying up and matching with each other, and you know, for social care workers, that people are working together to make sure resources are appropriate for them.
Even this conversation is really, you know, so-and-so, you know, so-and-so, like you say, it's all interwoven, and everybody is trying to help each other reach the goal, you know.
Brilliant.
And the other thing was, actually Social Care Ireland went through with a fine-tooth comb or a competency framework, and they have endorsed it. So that's really wonderful, because they did that really with the view to it being a really useful tool for anybody who was trying to consider, where do I start with Curra? Because the competency framework really is a great place to start.
That's fantastic. It's a pity we don't have a competency framework for other services as well, other than disability services. Do you know what I mean? Like we could do one for homelessness, young people in care, aftercare even. Do you know what I mean? What do you think, Baggy?
Yeah, I think aftercare is a big one. Like, as you say, you were at the conference there a while ago.
Yeah.
And from having the likes of Paul and 801 kind of come into conversations, it does rear its head very often. It's the specific tracks and where to go.
You know, we ran the mental health, supporting people with intellectual disability with mental health difficulties earlier this year, and Social Care Ireland funded it.
Was it CPD with Social Care Ireland? Was that it?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So it was so successful that they've already secured funding for next year as well. So that's something else for, you know, people to know about as well. Keep an eye out. It's not going to get advertised until September, but it is a 7-day program, and I facilitate the 7 days.
Is it in person or online?
So it is in person, but it's online in person. And that's really just so that people can come from all corners of the globe, really, without having to travel. Now, there may be some travel days, but mostly it's online. And the other thing actually is the group set up a WhatsApp group, kind of a professional development group for people who are supporting people with intellectual disabilities and mental health difficulties as well. So just to say, those kind of little things are kind of mushrooming out as well from the work that's going on.
That's fantastic. So Martha, I'd just like to say a huge thank you for coming on the Social Care Podcast today. I've really enjoyed our conversation and I've learned a lot from it.
And I enjoyed catching up again. I said our cup of tea, but we learned something new every time we
sit. But no chocolate biscuits this time, David. I mean, you know,
you have to BYO, bring your own.
Guys, can I just say, and this was a fantastic opportunity for me. Like, I'm delighted. Thank you so much for inviting me. Really appreciate it.
You're welcome. And we'll catch up again soon.
Thank you for joining us this week as we interviewed Martha McGinn from the National Institute of Intellectual Disability Studies. We've put some links below in the comments just in case you want to find out some more information about the NIIDS. Join us next week as we chat with Simon Keating, who is a Restorative Justice Project Officer with Lacaila Mentoring in Limerick. You won't want to miss this. It is a very interesting conversation where we talk all about restorative practice and restorative justice. Take care.